On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's officially summertime today, and we all want a dip in the pool. But which pool? In their heyday, at their best, America's public swimming pools were cool blue pleasure zones where happy kids and adults of all stripes showered down and splashed in. But just as often, they were cultural battlegrounds over unwashed immigrants, race, gender, class, and public sexuality. Now, many are closed, and America likes to swim in private pools. But in the joyous echoes of kids at play, there is a big story in America's swimming pools. Up next on Point, the birth of a nation at the pool. Joining me now from Missoula, Montana, is Jeff Wiltse. He's a professor of history at the University of Montana and author of the fascinating new book, Contested Waters, A Social History of Swimming Pools in America. Jeff Wiltse, thanks very much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Tom. It's my pleasure.
We read Dick Cavett, of all things, Dick Cavett's review of your book over the weekend, and he, like us, said, you know, I didn't expect to be amazed by what was between these covers or in these waters, but I was, and so were we. Who knew that such a remarkable story unfolded around our essentially public pools?
Yeah, for most of the reason we don't know is that it hadn't really been written about previously, that I was fortunate enough to stumble across it, really dream up this idea, and found out quickly that no one had written on the history of municipal pools in America. And so that's why it's really an unknown story up until now.
You know, even that phrase municipal pools begins to have a little antique phrase to it. I mean, there was a time when that's where almost everybody went if they wanted to cool off. But so many private pools in the United States these days, and increasingly lavish. I saw some numbers. I think, you know, it wasn't, what, even in the 50s, maybe only a couple of 100,000 private pools, and today many millions, 3, 4, 5, 6, I've seen 7 million. What's the ratio of private to public pools in the country these days?
Well, it's hard to tell. That the swimming pool industry, the builders industry, keeps very good statistics on how many residential pools are being built. And yet there aren't similarly comprehensive numbers of municipal pools. What I can say is that during the first half of the 20th century, there were definitely more municipal public pools in existence than there were private pools, whether private club pools or residential pools, but that has changed significantly and dramatically during the second half of the 20th century, in which there are now magnitudes and magnitudes more private pools than there are municipal pools. And what's more important, it seems to me, is not just the relative numbers, but that municipal pools have been in decline during the second half of the 20th century at the same time that the number and popularity of private pools has skyrocketed.
Are they still being shuttered? Are the numbers of public municipal pools still retreating?
Well, it's tough to tell. What I've found is in the last, say, 10 to 15 years, that there has actually been a trend towards building public water facilities or public aquatic facilities, but that the trend has now been more to build water parks, which have all sorts of play apparatuses with them, rather than the traditional pool. And on the one hand, I think that it's a positive sign that there has been a recommitment in many communities to provide water-based public facilities for residents. And yet, there are some things about the water parks that make them, I think, different and less vital civic institutions than the traditional pool, in that when you're at a water park and you have water cannons and lily pads and things like that, that in many ways the interaction that individuals are having are with the play apparatuses, not with other individuals. Whereas at a pool, the nature of being at a pool is interacting with other people. And I think that in some ways we've lost the sociability of being at a pool with these water parks.
That social intimacy that pools produced between people of very different backgrounds, races, genders, points of origin, lies right at the heart of what you're talking about here. I want to begin to sort of paddle out into the deep end of what you're bringing us, Jeff. You've got quite a list of fingerprints that you see coming out of the municipal pools. Urbanization,
the erosion of Victorian culture, progressive reform, the emergence of popular recreation, the gender integration and racial segregation of public space, the sexualization of public culture. Wow, you've got a lot going on there. Begin at the top of that list. Urbanization. I mean, were public pools in the first place all about the fact we were in cities and not by swimming holes in Tom Sawyer country anymore?
Yeah, that there was significant urban growth during the mid to late 19th century. And along with that urban growth arose all sorts of problems. The most notable of those problems, at least to people at the time, were epidemic diseases, that diseases would spread through a community and really have a profound unhealthy impact upon the lives of citizens, I mean, causing a large number of deaths. And so the first pools were intended to function as public baths. And many of
public baths in the sense of get clean, get yourself clean in this water altogether now.
Yeah, and there's two critical points. One is that in the poorer neighborhoods of cities at the time, the housing didn't have bathing facilities. And so if public officials and reformers wanted the poor and the working classes to clean themselves, they had to provide the facilities for them. And so one of those facilities were the first public pools. And it's best to think of them quite literally as large public bathtubs, that there weren't showers attached to the pools,
right,
that dirty people would come in, plunge themselves into the water, and would literally clean their bodies within this large pool of water.
You point out this was before the germ theory of pathology of disease, and so they weren't thinking about what they might be sharing in those pool waters, that big bathtub.
Right, that the thinking at the time was known as the zymotic theory of disease transmission. And basically what the assumption was is that disease is transferred from one person to another through dirt and dirtiness and decaying matter. And so the assumption was by bringing the poorest and presumably dirtiest of urban Americans and getting them clean in this pool that they were in fact combating the spread of disease. The reality was, though, and this was popularly accepted during the 1890s, was that the diseases were actually transferred from one person to another through microbes, and that a tepid body of water was in fact a very good medium for transferring the disease from one person to another. And so almost overnight, or at least historically speaking, overnight during the 1890s, swimming pools went from being – or pools went from being considered sanitary boons to really sanitary hazards.
And on both sides of that, they were really seen as something – a kind of a bathing place for inner-city immigrants who – I mean, some of the things you quote here, immigrants were considered – I mean, the dirtiness was a huge factor. These weren't places that people of means about the city were likely to find themselves in up to their neck.
Correct. During the late 19th and early 20th centuries, municipal pools were intended to serve the working classes in American cities, and it was primarily young working class boys who used them. And when I say working classes, I mean blacks, native-born whites, and immigrants. One of the interesting things that I found was that when pools were gender segregated and were located in poor residential neighborhoods during the late 19th and early 20th century.
And they were gender segregated because people couldn't imagine swimming together, the sexes swimming together at that time.
Exactly. And that blacks and whites swam together really in relative harmony. And the conflict that I found that occurred between black and white swimmers at the time was really analogous to the same type of conflict that I found across ethnic lines, say between a Polish immigrant and an Irish immigrant swimming in the same pool. And so what I found was that race was not a significant social division or social distinction in the use of municipal pools during the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
But then came a big change around the turn of the century. You described by 1913 you had in places like St. Louis, the Fairgrounds pool, these spectacular large pools, and men and women showing up together. What was the next big turn of the pool trend there?
Yeah, so Fairgrounds Park Pool in St. Louis, which as you point out opened up in 1913, was a little bit ahead of its time. And so St. Louis built this enormous pool. Fairgrounds Park Pool was circular, which in and of itself was an innovation rather than the typical rectangular pool. And it was 400 feet in diameter, absolutely enormous.
Huge, yeah.
And yeah, in one side of it was surrounded by a sand beach. And so it's clear that this pool was intended to function as a leisure resort. And city officials in St. Louis, because it was intended to function as a leisure resort, applied the social standard of the seashore to it, in which men and women had been going to the seashore together for quite some time. And so permitted males and females to be there together. And it also attracted working class and middle class residents. And so you see when cities begin to build leisure resort pools that the previous social divisions along sex lines and class lines evaporate. But what happens at that point is that cities and white swimmers begin to impose racial segregation. And so it occurred in St. Louis in 1913, but the general trend nationally towards building leisure resort pools really occurred in the 1920s and 1930s. So in this case, St. Louis was ahead of its time. But when other cities began to build these large leisure resorts, the same thing happened. Gender integration, class integration, racial segregation.
We'll look at the racial piece of this, but the sexual tensions came first. You write the St. Louis Big Fairgrounds pool being described as a sexually charged public space with men and women there in a kind of moral panic that set off. It seems quaint today, but it was very real then. Let's go right to Michelle in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you know?
Well, you know, we grew up in, I live in Virginia Beach now, but we grew up in Wisconsin, in Wausau, Wisconsin, and they had the most wonderful municipal pool system. Cost 10 cents to go swimming all day.
Oh, right.
And it was just a great experience. It was the most memorable experience of my childhood. You know, when I look back, those are the days that I remember most. We lived at that swimming pool, and my brothers and I, we'd ride our bikes down there, and we would just spend the whole day there every day all summer long.
Right at the center of your summer, and many other people's, it sounds, Michelle.
That's probably the center of my life.
And today, so, you know, do you still go to the public pool? Do you still strip off in the locker room down there, or does that seem, you know, forget it now?
No, I've moved to Virginia Beach, where there are no municipal pools to speak of, except for indoor ones at the rec center. And so a lot of private pools. My children have not had the same experience. But and we, you know, we go to the Y and things like that. But, you know, it's not the same.
Not those same lazy days at the pool. Michelle, thanks for calling. Jeff, I don't mean to be forward with Michelle there, but there is an intimacy about the public pool that has thrown people together when it worked like almost nothing else in our public realm.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's a couple things to be said. I mean, I describe swimming pools as being special places. And what Michelle talked about with her childhood experience, it just exemplifies that for one, that the contact that people have at a swimming pool is both sustained and interactive. As she described, you don't go to a pool for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Rather, you go to a pool for hours and hours. You spend the entire day there. And that while you're at the pool, you're constantly interacting with other people, swimming in the water, playing games along maybe the grassy lawn that's nearby, or chatting with people on the deck. And it's very interactive contact. And then the second, and this is what I think you were alluding to, is that the contact that occurs between people is very dynamic because swimming pools are intimate spaces. And so I think that people are much more conscious about how they're presenting themselves to others, how others are presenting themselves to them, and that there's a heightened awareness of how they're interacting precisely because there's an eroticized, sexualized quality to the atmosphere at pools.
There's that piece, and we'll look at it. But you remind us also that in the locker room, we strip off many of the indicators of social class and standing. The clothes are gone. The watch is gone. Much of the jewelry may be gone. By the time Americans got into the public pool, they were sort of – everybody was an everyman.
Yeah, we live in a consumer society in which people – have certain assumptions about other people based upon the car that they drive, the house they live in, the type of clothes or jewelry that they have. One of the nice things about swimming pools is it strips away so many of those material accoutrements that are critical to one's identity in a consumer society, and that people go into a pool and you really can't tell so much the social class of other people while they're there at the pool. And I think that helps to diminish some of the social differences along class lines that keep people separate in other social spheres.
Let's follow a couple of these threads through. There's the race piece, and we'll look at that in just a moment. But let's go first to the gender/sexuality piece here. Take us all the way back to when Americans didn't even swim together. How did that work? And then once, as you remind us, the genders came together, how did those giant bathing, you know, head-to-toe suits come off? How did the sexualization of public swimming unfold in this country?
Yeah, so several things happened pretty much simultaneously. That, as I said before, that most cities throughout the country began to build these large leisure resort pools in the 1920s and the 1930s. Mm. And that's when city officials first permitted males and females to swim together. Now, when that happened, the other thing that occurred was that the size of acceptable swimsuits began to shrink. And there's several explanations for that. One is sort of popular culture, that there were many movies during the 1920s and early 1930s that had swimming pool scenes, and the actresses wore relatively revealing swimsuits. And so that created a demand and also kind of reshaped cultural standards. But what I focus on in the book is the way in which young women in particular pushed the boundaries of public decency by continually wearing skimpier and skimpier and skimpier swimsuits. And finally, the magistrates and the public officials responsible for regulating this and then punishing women who wore too revealing of a swimsuit finally said, well, this must be the new cultural standard, and so we're going to sort of allow the tighter-fitting, more skimpy one-piece suits that young women were wearing. And so you get gender integration. You get the shrinking size of swimsuits. The other thing that you get are sandy beaches and sun decks. And so now males and females are not simply in a pool of water swimming around,
right,
but they're laying out, really displaying their bodies. And so it's at that point in time that exhibitionism and voyeurism become critical parts of swimming pool culture. And the combination of all these things really transforms pools into sexualized spaces.
Past the tanning butter, I should say you can read an excerpt of Jeff's book and see some remarkable photographs from old-time swimming pool scenes at our website, onpointradio.org. I really encourage you, check out these photos. They are really fascinating. When the sexualization and the opening of pools ran into the issue of race, things really got hot in a hurry. You described this heartbreaking scene in Ohio that sort of tells the whole story about how rough it was for minorities to come into the public pool.
Yeah, it's a poignant and revealing story. And so the story is from 1951, and it's in Youngstown, Ohio, and a Little League baseball team. And so the Little League baseball team was racially integrated, that there was a young boy named Al Bright who was black, who was on this baseball team, and I think everyone else on the team was white. And so they'd won the city baseball championships, and the whole team then went to the local municipal pool. It was called Southside Pool, to swim. And everyone else was let in except for Al, in that the pool manager told the coach that the unwritten rule is clear, that you know what the unwritten rule is, in that blacks aren't allowed in the pool. And so they forced Al to sit on the outside of the pool area, outside the fence, looking in as everyone else was swimming in the pool. And after a while, the parents and the coach became uncomfortable with this situation and went to the manager and pleaded with him, well, can't Al come into the pool for at least just a little bit so he can feel as though he's a part of the team? Mm. And so finally, the manager relented and said, okay, Al can come into the pool, but only if everyone else in the water gets out and Al sits inside a rubber raft. And so Al got inside a rubber raft, a lifeguard got in the water with him and then floated him back and forth along the pool a couple times as he was doing this. And you can just picture this.
This young black man's or boy's reward for the big baseball tournament is one trip around the pool inside a rubber raft with everybody else out and the lifeguard saying to him,
just don't touch the water. Whatever you do, don't touch the water.
It's amazing. Let me go to Williamsburg, Virginia, and Sue Ellen. Hi, Sue Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, Sue Ellen. I'm sorry. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm from Williamsburg.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Newport News, and I remember the neighborhood pool that we had. We would walk to it, and it's the first and only and last time I ever was able to go off a high dive. I guess insurance laws now being what they are, there's no such thing anymore in a public pool.
But it sure was a great thing about public pools, that exciting look down into the water far away. Were there segregation issues there, Sue Ellen?
Yes, it was. The pool was located in a neighborhood that was gradually being taken over by blacks. And once the whites and the blacks never swam together, as your author just noted, and once the blacks began to demand, when integration was came on board, the blacks took over the pool and the whites no longer went to it. There was not a new pool built for whites, but eventually the pool was closed. The city chose not to maintain the pool for the blacks.
So the color of the population in the neighborhood changed, integration came, and the races parted ways. Sue Ellen, thanks for the memory, a tough one. Jeff, this is a story that was repeated all over the country.
Yeah, what I found, and this was a sad but all too common occurrence, was that when municipal swimming pools throughout the northern United States were racially desegregated, and mostly they were desegregated by federal court decisions, that white swimmers generally abandoned them. In city after city after city, when a pool that had previously been used or earmarked for whites became racially integrated and black Americans began swimming there, that the overall attendance at these pools plummeted, in some cases by over 90%, and that it's clear that the majority of whites were unwilling to swim with black Americans in municipal pools, and that this was one of the real primary causes for the beginning of the decline of municipal swimming pools in America, that as attendance declined and as many of the swimmers became racial minorities, that public officials and communities downgraded the public importance of municipal pools. So they stopped building so many new pools, they neglected maintenance, and the pools became dilapidated, and then they would close them rather than pay for costly repairs. And so the irony of desegregation is that, as your caller points out, it really did not lead to meaningful interracial swimming. Rather, what it did oftentimes is transfer use of particular pools from whites to blacks.
And that sets us up for where pools have come much more recently. Racial issues plus a new wave of affluence saw the number of private pools absolutely explode. I want to explore that for just a moment, if I may, with Erica Taylor. She's editor of Pool and Spa Magazine. She joins us from West Hollywood, California. Erica Taylor, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom.
So now we have millions of private residential pools around this country. You follow this day in and day out. What's the latest trend in private pools? Are the numbers still exploding? Has the housing crunch taken that down a little bit? And what kind of features are people looking at the sort of leading edge of private pools today?
Well, the housing crunch has certainly had an impact on residential swimming pools, although, you know, the market is very strong in the sort of custom high-end pools. You know, people with a lot of wealth are always going to want to trick out their pools, and that trend has been continuing regardless of the housing market.
And what are they spending? How big? With what kind of features, Erica?
Well, one thing that we're seeing more and more of in pools is fire features.
Fire?
There's something incredible about the combination of fire and water.
So they're building fireplaces into the side of the pool?
I saw one recently that was sort of like a fire, almost like a fireplace right near the pool where you could actually see the flames and the water in very close proximity. You see sort of like fire bowls. If you can imagine,
okay.
With like a bowl with sand in it, and then there's material on the sand that creates a fire, and you can't see the sand. It just looks like there's flames shooting out of this bowl.
And I suppose the jacuzzi-style deal and the sort of waterfalls, that's almost passé now. I mean, lots of people are putting those in as well.
A lot of people. You see a lot of pool-spa combinations. Yeah, pool-hot tub combinations is very, very popular. You see a lot of water features that combine the pool and the spa area. You know, beautiful spillover water features where the water is sort of sheeting, almost like this razor glass effect that's stunning where it comes out of the spa.
Sub-zero kitchens being put in right next to the pool, Italian tile and all that?
The whole concept of the outdoor room, the backyard is no longer just a place to kind of go and be, and then go back into your house. It is now an extension of the home. So people treat it like it's part of their home in a way that traditionally we haven't seen.
Erica, your magazine celebrates all this, and of course people really enjoy it when they've got it, but do you ever pause, and I don't know what your own childhood was, but do you ever miss the idea of the really great municipal pool, public pool, rather than all this lovely private pool extravagance?
Well, there is certainly a lot of extravagance in private pools, but the vast majority of private pools in this country are just built for, regular people. You know, you don't have to have, laminar jets and fire features and vanishing edges to enjoy the pool with your family and your friends.
Regular people, what do people spend on pools these days, Erica, at the regular end?
At the regular end? Oh, gosh. I mean, if you're looking at a vinyl liner pool or a fiberglass pool, depending on what region of the country you're in, you can go as low as under $30,000 if you're careful.
And if it gets fancier, to a solid side pool, gunite, or I don't know what people use these days?
Sure, a gunite pool in an area of the country where it's more expensive, you know, the sky's the limit.
Sky's the limit, as in literally, I mean...
Literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars I've seen spent on pools.
It's a big splashing world out there. Erica Taylor, thanks very much for being here. Jeff, when you look at the world of private pools these days, with everything you've learned about public pools, I don't know, what does it inspire in you? Just the desire to have one yourself or something else? Some of the thought.
No, I can't help but connect the proliferation of private pools with the decline of municipal pools. And so when I think about how many private, especially residential pools are being built, what it makes me think of is that that has played a significant role in the downgrading of the public importance of municipal pools. And I mean, I guess there's several points that I can make, but one that I'll make now, and maybe we can come back to it, is that it's a significant investment in domestic recreation. I mean, it's not simply, I mean, in other words, that in the book, I interpret the proliferation of private, especially residential pools, as being exemplary of civic disengagement, sort of a retreat from public life.
To your own backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and abandonment, I mean, fencing yourself in and fencing everyone else out. And to my mind, it is a particularly profound act of civic disengagement precisely because of how big of an investment it is. It's not simply saying to oneself, oh, I'm going to choose to stay home today rather than walk over to the public park. It's saying I'm going to spend an immense amount of money to make sure that I can recreate at home. And while I think a lot of people don't think about this consciously, it's also saying – or it's implicitly leading to, so I don't go out and recreate in public.
There was a time when Americans were still being tutored in how to use and enjoy the public pool. Here's a 1950 public service film soundtrack produced by General Electric extolling the virtues of convenient and public swimming.
For most people, young or old – no form of recreation has greater appeal than a relaxing swim on a summer afternoon. And today they are able to enjoy the luxury of modern, up-to-date pools if they are fortunate enough to live in a progressive community.
There we are back in Dick and Jane country. A progressive community, progressive reform, deep in this history, you write, Jeff Wilsey.
Yeah, so... the progressive reform movement was really during the first two decades of the 20th century, and it was really progressive reformers that redefined swimming pools from being fitness facilities. So initially, pools, municipal pools, were intended to function as baths, as I said before.
Yep.
And then with the popular acceptance of the germ theory of disease transmission, for a very short period of time, municipal pools were redefined as being fitness and sport institutions, really intended to serve for swimming laps and races and diving competitions and even water polo. But what happened early in the 20th century is that progressive era reformers said, hey, the best thing that we can do with swimming pools is to use them as recreation facilities and locate them still in urban, poor urban neighborhoods and use them as devices or means of attracting immigrant, black, native-born white working class youths off the streets, sort of out of the gambling dens, out of the saloons, and bring them to this public space in which there would be some form of oversight. And so in many ways, progressive reformers used pools as a means of social control, as a way of curbing juvenile delinquency and giving them some sort of monitoring oversight over working class youths in large cities.
Walk, don't run, and mind your manners at the pool. Let's go to Mitch in Caro, Michigan. Hi, Mitch. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. Good subject. You're stirring up some memories for me.
Let's hear them.
When I was in, from birth up to age five, I was in Pontiac, Michigan, and we used to swim at a local high school there. Then we moved out to a more rural area, Waterford, Michigan, and... then around 19, where I swam in a lake, and then around 1976, they built the Waterford Oaks Wave Pool, an Olympic-sized pool, and I can remember skateboarding in it before they actually filled it with water. And I spent the summer of 76 and 77 almost every day in that pool.
How old were you then, Mitch, when you were in that pool every day?
I was probably, I think I was around 11, 10 or 11.
And what did it mean to you? Did you just take it for granted that you would swim with everybody in town at that pool, long lazy days?
Yeah, it was awesome. And there were some black people, and there was never a problem. It never crossed my mind because I thought they're just people. So that was never an issue in my mind anyhow, and it wasn't publicly at the pool. But it was just great fun. And the songs, the music they played was the radio over the speakers. And I'll be driving today at 43 years old, and I'll hear old days from Chicago or Saturday in the Park or something like that.
And you're right back at the poolside.
Bam, I smell the chlorine. And
we've got it. Mitch, thanks for that. Jeff, you know, the candy bar, the music, the sort of sense of summer celebration shared by a big public, very powerful. There you hear again in Mitch's reminiscence.
Yeah, as I write about in the book, and I think I write about this at the very end in the conclusion, my most vivid childhood memories are of being at the local pool that I grew up at, as some of your other callers did, every day. I mean, every day during the summer, I went to the local pool. And those are by far my most vivid childhood memories. And this is the point that your callers are making as well, is that thinking back, what they remember most in many ways and remember most clearly and vividly was the time they spent at pools. And that's why I end the book by really almost a plea, is we need to continue to – communities need to continue to provide pools so my children and future generations can really have those same vivid memories that we all have.
The romance of that public pool. Let's hear some more. Julia in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh.
We were definitely kids of the neighborhood. I grew up in Augusta, Maine, and while my friends, some of them had, pools at home, mm-hmm. it was much more exciting to go to one of the many local municipal pools. They all had baseball fields, playgrounds.
Right.
One of them was next to an old elementary school. And they were also integrated into the rec program, the city rec program, where kids could get free lunch and sometimes for like a small fee go to see different beaches in the state or go to a water park.
So it was the center in a way, and I have the same memory, Julia, of a kind of welcoming world that picked you up, showed you the fun side of life and helped you have it.
It was great. Yeah, it was wonderful. And especially because the social differences, the socioeconomic, especially the kids who, wouldn't maybe have gotten lunch every day at home, could get free lunch there. And the other kids could enjoy being with their friends and see a state that they might, not otherwise see.
Is that still part of your life or of the kids that you know these days, Julia?
Oh, definitely. Like, little kids that I grew up with who are now a little bit older are lifeguards there. And I remember thinking that the older lifeguards were so cool. Like, they were the role models and the,
sure.
the ones we really wanted to go see.
Yeah, a lot of icons, local icons made at the poolside. Julia, thanks very much for your call. Jeff, I want to invite another voice in, if I may, for a moment, from Atlanta, Georgia. We're really lucky to have with us Sabir Muhammad. He's a national advocate for promoting swim instruction for inner-city youth and non-swimming parents. More than that, he was, as a Stanford University senior in 1998, he became the first African-American to set an individual national swimming record. It was in the 100-yard butterfly, I think. Sabir, was that it?
That's correct.
What was your time, old national record holder, then?
Oh, man, that was nearly 10 years ago, but it was exactly 46 seconds.
Why did it take so long for an African-American with all of the African-American splendor in so many sports to set a national record in swimming?
Well, I mean, really what we're dealing with here, and I haven't read Jeff's book yet, but what he's speaking to is social issues, and it's a social reason why African-Americans haven't set more records in swimming. I don't know if you guys know the statistics, but drowning is a leading killer of American children. In ethnic communities, drowning rates are nearly three times the national average.
And do you mean drowning in pools in particular, Sabir?
Exactly. They're usually urban pools that these kids drown in.
Why?
They sneak into at night with no supervision and with limited swimming skills, looking to have a good time, and in the process, drownings occur. So that's just one aspect. The other aspect is, just the educational aspect of swimming. I think this is an excellent opportunity to really talk about putting swimming in the school systems across the country, because it is a skill that will save your life, and there are very few other sports that can claim that.
Sabir, we've talked with Jeff Wiltse, and his book goes into great detail about how swimming pools became dividing lines around race. But there was also, this, I don't know what you call it, spurious research or urban legend, you know, back from the 60s that blacks were like inherently less buoyant, disadvantaged in water. And I think that's still out there in the public today. Is there any truth in that? Is that completely bogus? You're a swimmer.
Well, you know, this is really interesting you brought that up. The first article ever written about me was in response to Al Campanis's claim. I think it was in 1984. He said the blacks were too dense to swim. He was speaking on ABC Sports, and this was a celebration of Jesse Owens.
Dense as in muscle density or something. I don't know what he
meant. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not blacks. It's people. Some people have that body type. Some people are dense people, which means that they'll have a tougher time learning to swim. But everybody, regardless of your body type, can learn to swim. As humans, we have an innate ability to swim. We were born in water. So I really believe that it's the physiological means that people try to put behind not being able to swim is really another social block that they're trying to instigate.
And you've reached out not just to kids, and we can hear them behind you there in Atlanta, but very importantly to parents as well with swimming instruction.
Yeah, I want parents to learn to swim. My story is very much like the story of the Giving Tree. I don't know if you guys are familiar, but there's a story about a boy in a tree. Well, my story is really about a boy in a swimming pool. I started going to a pool with my mother when I was 7 years old, and she didn't know how to swim, but something told her to take me to the pool because she knew it would be important for me to learn to swim. And as a result of my learning to swim, my first job was as a lifeguard. I got a full scholarship to Stanford University. And even after graduating from college, I am still very much involved with the sport of swimming. I represent Gary Hall Jr., who is an Olympic, a 10-time Olympic medalist. And my partner and I at Arlet Promotions, we represent him in terms of his endorsements and his management. Mm. So swimming has been the giving sport to me.
Sabir Muhammad, it's a great story, and we hear you right in the middle of it. We thank you very much for joining us with that story today.
Thank you very much.
Let's take a call from Newport News, Virginia. Shirley, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is Shirley, and I'm calling kind of in response to a call from Williamsburg. Sue Ellen, I think, said that she has been swimming in a Newport News pool. I think I predate her.
Okay.
Because I was swimming in the pool just about a half a block down my street that was built by the locally owned shipyard after the war.
What? So we're talking the 40s here or early 50s, Shirley?
Mid-late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And so they built the recreation center, and they also built the swimming pool. So it was really great. But since it was segregation time, in addition to building that one about two blocks away, they built one for the African Americans.
So you remember segregated swimming right down to the very facility.
Right. Uh-huh. And like I say, they were not that far apart, so that gives you some idea of how close the people were living. But the neighborhoods were segregated, and so was the swimming pool.
Shirley, thanks for that memory. Let me get another call here, if I may, from Providence, Rhode Island. Liz, you're on the air.
Hi. I actually grew up in public pools in Bucks County, Pennsylvania in
yep.
the 80s.
Yeah.
And now living in Providence, I actually don't know that many people who have been to public pools up here. When I talk to most people about it, they get very, oh, how could you have gone in those pools? They must have been so germy.
Germy, what about chlorine?
Yeah, it seems like, well, there was a lot of it. But it seems like these days people I know are so paranoid about the germ aspect of public pools. They're afraid to go in them because, well, kids go to the bathroom in there, or, people are just kind of dirty, or, you know, aside from seeing them in apartment complexes occasionally, I just haven't seen the big pools we had in Pennsylvania.
Liz, that's an interesting point. Jeff, what about it, this sense of the hygienic safety of pools and its rise and fall? What's that trend line been like, and where do you see it today?
Yeah, I mean, swimming in a pool is really an act of intimacy. that you're sharing water and whatever's on the other person's body and potentially diseases. But as you say, chlorine obviously kills the diseases. But still, there's the potential to come into contact with the dirtiness or sort of the urination of another swimmer. And in that, I mean, to go back historically, that was one of the main reasons I argue that the middle classes did not want to swim with the working classes during the late 19th and early 20th century, that the middle class saw the working classes en masse as the great unwashed and thus didn't want to enter the same pool of water with them. And then during the 1920s and 1930s, after large numbers of black Southerners begin to migrate up to northern cities and the large inflow of poor European immigrants coming to the country drops significantly, that black Americans become in many ways the most conspicuous poor in northern cities. And so the health prejudices that had previously been directed at the working classes now get focused on black Americans. And then along with the concerns about intimacy between black men and white women, concerns that black Americans are more likely to be dirty and have communicable diseases also plays a significant part in the onset of racial segregation.
The prejudice flows into the pool very easily. We've only got a couple of minutes. When you look at it big picture today, Jeff, what do you see? Are we ever going to go back to the heyday, you know, brief as it may have been between these different chapters of the public pool, or with all this privatization, is that something that's going to seem as strange as Roman baths to future generations of Americans?
I'm not optimistic. I think that two things need to happen for us to get back to the type of pool culture, municipal pool culture that had existed previously. One is that communities have to be willing to devote public resources to building municipal pools. The second is that they have to build pools that are appealing to a wide cross-section of Americans. What made the swimming pools that were built during the 1920s and 1930s so special is that they were enormous pools, many of them larger than football fields. They had sand beaches. They had sun decks, big grassy lawns. In other words, they were leisure resorts that appealed to a broad cross-section of Americans. Unfortunately, most of the pools that are being built today are not like that. They're much smaller. They're rectangular. They don't have nearly as much leisure space. And so they appeal to children perhaps, but they don't appeal to that broad cross-section of Americans that earlier pools had. And so what I'd love to see is for cities and towns across the country to go back to what they were doing during the 20s and 30s and building these enormous pools that were appealing to so many people.
Wouldn't it be great to do that with a little less prejudice in the air and bring back the kind of democratic glue that comes with all that joy in the water? Yeah, we'll say amen to that. Jeff Wiltse, it's been a fascinating conversation. The book, Contested Waters, is a terrific read. We're very grateful to you for being with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Jeff Wiltse joined us from Missoula, Montana, at the University of Montana. Listeners, thank you for being here as well. You can see an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org, and great photos there as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.